Hello and welcome to today's VJ Hemonc podcast. We are a global, open access video journal bringing you the latest in hematology and hematological oncology. In today's episode, we'll be sharing highlights from the 50th annual meeting of the EBMT, which was held in Glasgow, Scotland. In this episode, you'll hear from experts who draw focus on the treatment and management of graft versus host disease and the important role of the gut microbiome in this transplant-related complication. First, Mohamed Moti discusses current and emerging treatment approaches for acute and chronic GVHD.
Graft versus host disease, or GVHD, remains a key issue after allogeneic stem cell transplantation. Obviously, we have to distinguish acute and chronic GVHD. Thanks to the NIH consensus and efforts, we are able now to clearly make the difference between these different clinical entities. And that has allowed to improve the quality of research, but recently also to bring some new treatments into GVHD. If I focus on acute GVHD, actually, the first-line treatment remains high-dose steroids. Unfortunately, we don't have better options today. However, we know very well that roughly half of the patient will not be able to respond or will be steroid-dependent. And this is where, in the last 3 or 4 years, we've seen the advent of ruxolitinib, which has become a standard of care for steroid-refractory acute GVHD. So that's really good news. The bad news is that not everybody is able to respond to ruxolitinib, and some patient will lose the response to ruxolitinib. So we end up with a new group of patients who are very hard to treat, actually, the ruxolitinib-resistant or refractory or dependent patient. And here, we really need new options. And this is why I felt that we are fortunate enough, we've seen at this EBMT 2024 annual meeting in Glasgow, some new options, especially the modulation of the microbiota. And I was really impressed by the results, but also the safety profile of an experimental agent that was presented as part of the oral sessions on a large series of 140 patients who were treated in an early access program with fecal microbiotherapy based on the agent called MAT13. And the results are really impressive. You have an overall response rate at day 28, which is above 50%, roughly 60, almost 60%, especially in those patients who failed, who received and failed ruxolitinib. And these are patients who received a median of 2 lines of therapies, prior therapies for GVHD, up to 6 lines. And interestingly, almost all of these responses, more than 90%, are either CRs or VGPRs. And that is going to correlate with an improved survival. So really great news coming from the microbiota modulation. And I'm very excited about this. Now, looking into chronic GVHD, which of course is another matter of concern, especially with its impact on the quality of life of the patient, we've also seen the advent of ruxolitinib in steroid-refractory chronic GVHD. Very good news. But the other good news is that we have now another agent, different mechanism of action, namely a ROCK2 inhibitor, belumosudil, which is proving to be a key player in the field of chronic GVHD, with a very high response rate in heavily pretreated patients having advanced stages of chronic GVHD, more than 70%. And interestingly, all localizations are going to respond, including longer chronic GVHD. And this has been always a nightmare, I would say, because it's a totally terrible situation for patient. This is why I'm very optimistic when it comes to acute GVHD with the advent of JAK inhibitors, the advent of microbiota modulation with chronic GVHD, JAK inhibitors, ROCK2 inhibitors. I think the field is moving really nicely in the right direction and we'll get there. We'll be able, I think, to get rid of the severe and most debilitating GVHD situations. And obviously, this will allow to improve not only the survival, but also the quality of life of the patient. And that is the ultimate goal.
Next, Ernst Holler gives an overview of the important role of the gut microbiome and how this influences the severity of GVHD.
We have been involved in research on microbiota in GVHD since 2012. And soon after the first reports in single centers, we did multi-center trials together with New York and Japanese colleagues, and we could confirm that the loss of microbiota diversity is a predictor of poorer outcome and a predictor of mainly acute graft versus host disease. Now, of course, we have to think what induces this loss of this diversity, and there are three main reasons. By far, the most important reasons is that we are using broad spectrum antibiotics in the context of stem cell transplantation, of course, to treat, prevent neutropenic fever, but at the risk of damaging the microbiota in the gastrointestinal tract, especially the modern broad spectrum antibiotics almost completely eradicate protective commensal microbiota and leave very few protobionts like enterococci, and this induces a high loss of diversity. So broad spectrum antibiotics are a major reason. Another explanation is that GVH itself contributes to dysbiosis because we know in the gastrointestinal tract there are many cells producing antimicrobial peptides and inducing the interaction between the peaceful interaction between commensal bacteria and the human tissues. And we know that Paneth cells and other protective cells in the gastrointestinal tracts are very sensitive targets of acute GVHD. So acute GVHD destroys these cells. There is no production of antimicrobial and regulatory peptides, and that contributes to dysbiosis. There are also some recent data that the conditioning itself already starts to induce dysbiosis, but by far, Paneth cell damage and antibiotics are the most important reason. Now, in the last years, we tried to understand how dysbiosis contributes to GVH, what is the pathway from a dysbiotic microbiota to the damage. First of all, we know that commensal bacteria produce a large series of protective metabolites like short-chain fatty acids, but also indoles. We did a recent study, and I mentioned it in my presentation, on multiomics in the context of the intestinal microbiota, and we saw that almost all short-chain fatty acids, indoles, other immunostimulating metabolites like D-aminotyrosine, but also secondary bile acids, which was also mentioned by Marcel van den Brink in his talk, are lost. And these are all protective metabolites important for immunoregulation and also important for epithelial recovery, which are damaged by graft versus host disease. Further on, we used very modern techniques of biopsy analysis, doing single-cell analysis of the immune cells in intestinal biopsies by 10-time genomics and by multiplex staining using chip cytometry, where we could stain up to 12 antigens on an individual cell to really identify subpopulations. And there it was very clear that GVH is mediated by activated and clonal CD8 cells, but the other important population are regulatory T cells. And we could show by comparing stool microbiota and the cellular infiltrates that the absence of commensal bacteria results in diminished induction of regulatory T cells. We could even show with this modern techniques that if you correct dysbiosis by an FMT, the regulatory T cells and CD8 cells get into a much closer interaction. We measured the spatial distance between regulatory T cells and activated CD8 cells. After FMT, it was much lower, so they come together and Tregs can regulate the CD8 cells. So that's an important immunological mechanism explaining the effect of dysbiosis or of restoring the microbiota. Of course, there are many questions now. The most important is how we can correct this dysbiosis in order to improve the patient's outcome. And there are two approaches. The one approach is better antibiotic stewardship, because in early days, everyone believed we should give antibiotics as much as possible to make the patients germ-free, like in the animal models. But we know we never get germ-free patients. We induce severe dysbiosis by prolonged use of antibiotics. So we have to consider, do we really need to give antibiotics, for instance, for a very long time? We have to establish rules to earlier stopping antibiotics, of course, always not putting the patient at risk of infections. We also have to learn about the indication for antibiotics. We showed, we presented this data that, for instance, patients develop fever after serial therapy with ATG, and physicians frequently tend to give antibiotics as soon as a patient has fever, just to be sure that you do not treat an infection. But this fever is highly likely to be due to cytokine release, due to an immunological mechanism, so not due to an infection. So we did a study where we had the rule, if a patient develops fever after ATG, we wait for 12 hours with the antibiotics. And just by doing this, we could postpone the start of antibiotics by 6 days until the patients really developed neutropenic fever. And this resulted in a positive development of the microbiome and less dysbiosis, which is extremely important, especially in the first days after transplantation. So antibiotic stewardship is one approach. Of course, the other approach is doing fecal microbiota transplantation. There were several reports during the EBMT meeting. We now have more than 20 single-center trials, but also multi-center trials testing FMT in the context of refractory GVHD. And it's still, for me, surprising that about 40 to 50% of patients are responding even after the second line refractory acute GVHD to FMT. So microbiota correction seems to help, but what we now have to learn to identify those patients who have a benefit from fecal microbiota transplantation. In the moment, it's clear that patients who are on antibiotics have less effect of fecal microbiota transplantation, but there must be a lot of other factors, and these have to be identified in the future. The other point regarding FMT is, should we really use it so late in the course of acute GVHD? So one intention is to bring FMT and microbiota correction in earlier in the course of transplantation. There will be trials doing prophylactic FMT even before transplantation. Everyone wants to avoid to give fecal microbiota in the period of neutropenia because patients are highly sensitive to infections. So in these trials, the FMT is interrupted during neutropenia, but after recovery of the neutrophils, FMT is starts again, and we will see whether such early approaches give better results. We ourselves will do a biomarker-triggered first-line treatment study with steroids plus FMT in acute GVHD patients. Now, another important question which is currently discussed very broad in the field is how do we explain, on one hand, antibiotics are bad and induce dysbiosis and induce GVHD, but old experimental data showed that if we have germ-free mice, we also have less GVHD. And that's what I call the antibiotic paradox. On one hand, they seem to protect against GVHD. On the long run, they seem to make GVH worse. And we start to understand these effects. This is important because antibiotics also have a negative impact on other immunotherapies like CAR T cells or treatments with checkpoint inhibitors. And we have to look more carefully at the pathophysiology. So the long-term effect dysbiosis refers to the stool microbiota and to the metabolites produced by these microbiota. They affect, of course, the tissue, but there is another important part we shouldn't forget, and that is translocation of bacteria to the intestinal tissue. We did, for instance, in 2004 already a study where we analyzed bacteria in mesenteric lymph nodes of GVH mice. And we have seen in GVHD, you can grow a lot of living bacteria from the lymph nodes. And if you prevent, for instance, GVH in these mice by probiotics, then you can reduce the bacterial burden in the lymph nodes. Yeah. And so we're just beginning to have techniques also to see in biopsies which microbiota are translocated, which microbiota really interact with the T cells and the tissue. That's so far neglected. And it might well be that at some point antibiotics suppressing the translocated bacteria are beneficial, but the long-term use is deleterious, as I explained, because of the long-term sequelae on the microbiota. And that has to be considered, I think, more carefully when we discuss this antibiotic paradox. And we will see whether the new techniques allow us to work better on these different aspects of pathophysiology. So the final point open, or the several more open points in the context of microbiota, the current techniques of microbiota analysis go down to family levels of bacteria. But we have seen, and again, I showed this data, if we go down to strain-specific effects, the strains between bacteria are quite heterogeneous in their function and in their genetic material. So we have tested enterococci from patients, more than 300 strains from our transplanted patients, and we have seen that they are highly genetically variant. They are consistent within individual patients, but between patients, there are strong strain-specific differences. And no one knows at the moment what the strain-specific differences mean. We know that each strain has special enzymes like epitheliolysins or bacteriocidins killing other bacteria. And we have to decipher this strain-specific mechanisms to really understand what happens in the tissues. So I would say we currently just know about the tip of the iceberg in the situation of microbiota, but we have to go deeper for complete understanding. And this refers also to a further point. The question is, do T cells directly recognize bacterial antigens? There are more and more evidence that there is antigenic mimicry between tissue antigens and bacteria. For instance, in melanomas, they have some bacterial antigens identified, which are also tumor antigens. And to make the story even more complicated, many of these antigens are transferred by bacteriophages. Yeah? So we not only have to look at the bacteria, but also at the viruses and the bacteriophages to understand really what happens. So there's a lot of things to detect, which should help in the future to develop more specific approaches. For us, it's still a new world we are exploring, yeah, but which help to understand the pathophysiology much better in the future.
Lastly, Florent Mallard shares insights into how the gut microbiome can be manipulated to improve patient outcomes following allogeneic transplant.
So over the last decades, a lot of publication established a link between microbiome and the patient's outcome after allogeneic stem cell transplantations. In particular, there was a very large study that was conducted by Professor Van den Brink and Pellet in the Memorial Sloan Kettering in New York that established that patients that have a decreased microbiome diversity at baseline before transplant, but also at neutrophil recovery, have a lower overall survival. So this was very important to see that in patients, for example, in patients with very severe acute myeloid leukemia, when you look at the microbiome, this is already a predictor of patients' outcome. And in fact, when we look more in details, seems to be a link between the risk of graft-versus-host disease and infectious complications, and also maybe with the risk of relapse of the underlying diseases. Therefore, this is important to manipulate the microbiome to improve microbiome diversity and improve patients' outcomes. So what can we do? Of course, we can use some antibiotic sparing strategies. So there is some strategies to decrease the use of antibiotics, or at least to avoid the use of antibiotics with the broad antianaerobic spectrum, such as piperazine or penem. We can also use some kind of prebiotics. In particular, it was recently reported by Pavanwedi that you can use resistant potato starch that is safe. So it was only tested in 10 patients, but it seems to be safe and to increase, in particular, the butyrate producing bacteria in patients that have been associated with some protective effects. So this is some very preliminary data, because we don't have any information if when you give this prebiotic to the patient, it will improve the outcome, but it seems to be promising. And the last things we can do now easily, this is the use of fecal microbiota transplantation, of the use of microbiotherapeutic product. And this is we are going to do the ongoing Phoebus phase 2b clinical trials.
Thank you so much for listening to today's podcast. We hope you enjoyed. Be sure to follow us on Twitter at VJHemonk. And subscribe to VJHemonk podcasts on Spotify, Apple, and Podbean. Until next time.